Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we catch you up on all the political news of last week and preview our week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Joining me at the table this week are Aaron Glynn, state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Welcome back, Aaron.
Thanks for having me on.
Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Hi, Laura.
Hi, good morning.
She's joining us remotely because she is under the weather, but such a trooper that you are still joining us when sick. I appreciate you.
Thanks.
And finally, Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
It's great to be here on this Monday.
And it's official. Ohioans will be voting on redistricting again. Citizens, not politicians, submitted enough signatures to ask voters whether they want a brand new way to draw our congressional and state house district maps. Joe, this wasn't surprising. We expected them to have enough valid signatures, right?
Right. They needed about 414,000 valid signatures, and they turned in about roughly 535,000 valid signatures. Now, they turned in like over 700,000 signatures, but not all those were valid. They had, I think, 58 counties, well above the half of the counties that you needed. So they cleared the mark pretty easily. So the next thing that they have to do is go to the ballot board, which that could be a fight.
That's a
whole other thing, because when you look at, what's happened with amendments last year and how language was changed and what was done at the ballot board, it's going to be probably a fight there.
Yeah, for those who don't know, the ballot board is going to set the language that's actually going to appear when you go vote. So
right.
When you go vote and you see a little summary, that's what the ballot board decides. And this amendment is, 40 pages long? So you're not going to see the whole thing. That would be bananas.
Yes.
But how do you summarize it in a, quote, fair way?
Well, you know, like last year with the take the abortion amendment, for example, they wanted to take the top, the paragraph at the top that kind of summarizes it. And the people who were behind that amendment submitted that to the ballot board and said, here, use this. And Frank LaRose and the Republicans on the ballot board says, no, we're going to use this. And when you look at the difference in language, the one that was submitted was kind of a synopsis, used medical terms, used the word fetus. The one that was adopted used the words unborn child, used terms like late-term abortion, which is not a medical term. It had more charged language in it. Then there was a whole court thing, and the court said, yeah, you can use that Republican ballot board language. That's fine. And then when people went to the ballot in November, everyone said, well, this ballot is really confusing because, you know, they're saying that this protects miscarriage, but I don't see that in the language that they're, you know. So it was
a
confusing.
Whole big mess. Yeah.
Yes.
We'll probably see something like that again, but
yes.
Who knows? Laura, Republicans like Senate President Matt Huffman oppose this amendment. He said in a statement that it will guarantee wins for the left and the campaign should be called, quote, political outcomes over people. But noticeably, the top Republican in our state, Laura, hasn't taken a position. Governor Mike DeWine says soon, maybe?
Yeah, he says he's going to comment, I believe, sometime this week on it. And it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say, especially in light of reports that say that there could potentially be a second amendment that also purports to end gerrymandering, but would most likely preserve the Republican majorities in the state legislature and also in Congress. And this is kind of a tactic you're seeing, like in Nebraska, they have an abortion rights amendment this year. And to try to defeat that, Republicans in their state legislature have an amendment called like Protecting Women or something. And they say it would allow abortion through viability, but when you look at the technical language, it only allowed through 12 weeks. So this kind of is a trend we're seeing among Republicans. If they want to do that, they have until, I believe, is it August 7 or 9, really early in August. There are lawmakers not even in the United States right now. There's lawmakers on vacations, at trainings, things like that. It'll be hard to get them all in town. However, I would never underestimate the will of people who want to defeat this. Ohio is more Republican than it has been in previous years. And it is, you know, slightly more Republican than it is Democratic. However, when you look at, like, especially the legislature, which is what I cover, you know, most, and I see it, you know, it doesn't always line up. This particular constitutional amendment would require them to, there's some rules, like you have to keep communities together and you have to try to preserve like political leanings in certain areas of the state.
Yeah, Erin, you know, the lawmakers are on summer break and calling them all back. Now, the legislature has that authority, right? They can just pass an amendment that goes to the voters. They don't have to collect signatures. They don't have to jump through those hoops. They can just send something to the ballot. But, I mean, getting them all back together in the next 2 weeks and getting a redistricting amendment that all the Republicans can agree on, passed and out and on the ballot, that feels like a pretty heavy lift.
Yeah, because the deadline for the legislators to put the amendment on a ballot would be August 7th. So there would have to be callback, which they could do, or Governor Mike DeWine could call them back, but it doesn't seem like there's much of an appetite for that. And that's just a tight turnaround for them to get.
Because these are complicated amendments. I mean, technicality, how do you keep communities together? How do you create fair maps? Like, this is not an amendment that you can throw together in a day or two.
You know, one thing that I remember Governor Mike DeWine saying after the November amendment passed, he said, you know, one of the things was that voters went to the polls and they had, you know, basically two choices. They had what amounted to a 6-week abortion ban with almost no exceptions, or they had this amendment, which he says is much farther than most voters would have wanted to go. But they passed that amendment because it protected things that they thought were important. Like,
there was no middle ground choice.
Yeah, there was no rape clause in the 6-week ban. And, you know, he said if there would have been something that was a more middle ground choice, he thinks that that would have been what voters would have gone for. And, you know, we all heard that story in the summer of 22 about the 10-year-old rape victim who had to go to Indiana to get an abortion because our 6-week ban was in effect at that time. So, I mean, you know, that I think that kind of, at least for Governor DeWine, that's probably in the back of his head right now as he's trying to come up with some way to go against this amendment. And also,
I don't know that he really opposes it necessarily.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. That's my next thought. Because he said, you know, he was a little frustrated when they were going through all this redistricting. And I can remember he went in and he voted for it, but he wasn't happy about voting for it, you know? So I'm not sure. I'm interested to see where he stands and what he says. And hopefully we'll get some clarification on that this week.
Yeah, and he doesn't have to run for re-election ever again.
Exactly.
Laura, I have a technical question for you. If we have two redistricting amendments on the ballot in November, let's say that's the world that we live in, does the one with the most votes win? How does that work? Who wins in that situation?
Right. In Ohio, you just need a simple majority. So 50% plus one vote, and that's what wins. So in this case, it'd be like whichever got the majority vote. That would, or the higher vote.
Okay.
And then the other one would get tossed. So that's how they would be directly competing against each other.
That's kind of wild. So they could both pass with more than 50% of the vote. It would just come down to which one had more total.
Well, I mean, you only have 100% of the vote. But yeah, you know.
But yeah.
Whoever has the most.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's kind of crazy.
It could both pass, but the one with the most votes
would win.
That would take precedent.
And if you find redistricting complicated or confusing, you're in luck. Our next season of Untangled will unravel its history, how these independent commissions work in other states, and honestly, why gerrymandering matters. The first episode of Untangled Redistricting will drop August 26th. Let's move on to presidential politics. We've been talking about presidential politics a lot on the roundtable, but a lot has happened in the last week. You know, last week, President Joe Biden had just dropped out of the Democratic race. Vice President Kamala Harris is now the front runner for the Democratic nomination. You know, given the way she's bringing in donations and endorsements, Erin, I think it's safe to say we're not going to see a contested convention.
No, Ohio Democrats have really rallied around Kamala Harris as the presidential nominee. It seems like a lot of support. The Democratic congressional reps released statements in support of her, and so did the Ohio Democratic Party.
Yeah, she's also, Joe, she's raking in record fundraising numbers.
Yeah, over $100 million is the number I most recently saw. And not only that, I'm seeing an energy. Right after, I think it was the night after the decision was made by Joe Biden to back Kamala Harris, we saw where there was this meeting of like African American sororities, and it was
like 40,000 women on this call. It was
like
bananas.
4,000, yeah. I think. And then since then, you know, she's met with the Divine Nine. She's been at the historically Black colleges, and you know, talk to people, and there's an energy. You can see it, and then you know, like some of the groups that would ally with her, even like women's groups that are not devoted to necessarily African American causes, they're coming in and saying, yeah, we back her. So you're seeing a flurry of activity right now. Now, that's going to settle down at some point.
It could be a honeymoon period.
It could be a honeymoon period. But, you know, it's been interesting to watch because I don't think that Democrats actually expected this, you know, coalescing around her. And I don't think they expected all this to happen so quickly.
Yeah, also since last we sat at the round table, President Joe Biden did address the nation in the days after announcing he would end his campaign for a second term.
I believe my record as president, my leadership in the world, my vision for America's future, all merited a second term. But nothing, nothing can come in the way of saving our democracy. That includes personal ambition. So I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation.
What are you guys hearing from Ohio Republicans and Ohio Democrats in reaction to President Biden's address to the nation?
You know, from Republicans, the first thing I heard was, if Joe Biden can't run for re-election, then he shouldn't be in office, period, so he should step down today. Well, that's not going to happen, obviously. But I have heard a lot of mudslinging against the Republicans. They, you know, a lot of negative tweets about Joe Biden, about Kamala Harris, about the Democrats. That seems to be the tactic. The thing I'm still waiting to hear is like an actual, and I haven't heard exactly this from the Democrats either, but I'm actually wanting to hear some policies, some plans, because the Democrats are making a big deal about this Project 2025. And it's something that the Heritage Foundation has backed. And of course, you know, the Republicans are straying away from it because it's got some pretty conservative ideas in it. And even
even like ending NOAA, which is the National Weather Service.
Right. And so, you know, they're straying away from it, but I'm not hearing what they do stand for. It's not like they've put out a platform, and their platform committee that usually is open for the public viewing on C-SPAN. I mean, riveting, you know, stuff on C-SPAN. But still, you know, you can watch them as they're doing their, you know, that was closed this year. So they haven't really talked about, you know, if we're elected, here's exactly what we'll do.
Yeah, I think the reaction to Biden's speech to the nation last week really highlights how partisan we are in this moment, because I got some text messages during this speech from Republicans describing it as propaganda and the idea that he resigned of his own free will was a lie. And then you hear Democrats saying, look at, like, he put, you know, his country before his own ambition. Like, it's like people were listening to two totally different speeches depending on what political affiliation you have.
Exactly.
You know, Laura, I do wonder, though, how do you think Biden stepping down is going to impact our U.S. Senate race?
I think that Trump, even despite all the excitement over Kamala Harris, I think that Trump still has it in the bag for Ohio. And so as far as our U.S. Senate race, I don't know. I think this does help Sherrod Brown in the sense that he doesn't have such a dead weight that Joe Biden, frankly, had become leading the ticket. So that will help him But I still think, you know, nothing, we don't know yet, you know, it's still an open race. It's still a situation where either one could win. I think this house shared, but it doesn't secure anything for him.
No, I don't think so. Right. But if Kamala does 1 or 2 percentage points better in Ohio than Biden would, that could make all the difference for Sherrod Brown.
That's true. Depending. That is true. I know that to an extent, sometimes Sherrod Brown has tried to distance himself from the current president. I don't know if he will do that with Harris. Harris has been really out front about abortion rights, speaking very comfortably about it. And I know that's something that Sherrod Brown has also been very comfortable articulating. So maybe that's an area where they could kind of, you know, team up together. But other areas of Joe Biden, I mean, you know, Sherrod Brown was clearly not wanting him in the state campaigning for him. Like that. Yeah.
I don't know. You know, Aaron, I was kind of wondering about like Northeast Ohio, if Kamala could come and increase turnout. You know, Canton is one of those historically low turnout areas. Mm-hmm. If she can bring people to the polls in that northeastern corridor, that may be worth having her come. I don't know.
Well, you know, the thing is, I'm hearing a lot of Obama-esque kind of things coming from her right now. Last week we saw her.
It's got that vibe, yeah, I will say.
It does have a vibe like that. And last week her first like ad featured Beyonce, and it had that Obama-esque kind of vibe coming from it. And I do remember when Obama was here in, you know, before his first term, and he was running, there was the state house. He had a thing at the state house. It was blocks. The people for blocks, because there was such energy about that. And now, you know, no one can expect that from Kamala, but you just don't know how much the excitement will spread. And there are people who have been sitting on the sidelines, voters in Cleveland, in Akron, in Northeast Ohio. They haven't been coming out and voting. And if they're energized to get up and go vote, I mean, that could make a difference in this race. It could, you know, I think Trump still probably has the hold. I'm with you guys on that. But, you know, it could make a big difference if you get those voters engaged.
Yeah, I can see the energy increasing turnout more than people would have turned out for Joe Biden as a candidate, for sure.
That was Aaron Glynn, state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Coming up, childless cat ladies take on J.D. Vance. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, where we get you all caught up on all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us this hour is Aaron Glynn, state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, and Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. J.D. Vance hit the campaign trail last week. His first rally as the Republican nominee for vice president was here in his hometown of Middletown, Ohio. Vance returned here and was joined by State Senator George Lang, who had this to say when introducing J.D. Vance.
Fight! 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 We got time. Come on. Hey, we are in the fight for the soul of our nation. We are in a fight for our kids and our grandkids, a fight that we can never imagine. I believe wholeheartedly Donald Trump and Butler County's J.D. Vance are the last chance to save our country politically. I'm afraid if we lose this one, it's going to take a civil war to save the country, and it will be saved. It's the greatest experiment in the history of mankind. And if we come down to a civil war, I'm glad we got people like Schmitty and the Bikers for Trump on our side.
Lange's comments made national news, and the senator quickly apologized for them, saying he regretted the divisive remarks that he made in, quote, an excitement of the moment on stage. Laura, this was quite something. Even President Joe Biden commented on divisive language in the wake of the attempted assassination attempt.
Yeah, I'm really surprised. Lange did not miss a beat. I mean, he apologized right away. Because what you've seen sometimes with this kind of language is that, you know, they don't apologize until basically they're forced to. He did not. This was coming off of the Republican convention where there was very much a unity message, especially after somebody had attempted an assassination of Donald Trump. And so Donald Trump had decided to kind of like rebrand or change the tone of the convention to make it more unifying. And then, you know, Lange's comments up there on that stage was just the opposite of that. And so he came out and disavowed what he said very, very fast.
And I will say he didn't really equivocate. I give him credit. It was a real apology. It was like an I'm sorry, I screwed up apology.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was. You don't see that, unfortunately, too often from politicians. So.
But as my boss likes to say, Joe, sometimes political gaffes are the truth said by accident.
Well, you know, it's kind of an odd thing to say if you didn't really think it. If that thought wasn't in the back of your mind, where does that come from? You know, that being said, the whole unity thing seemed to last 5 minutes. And, you know, we are not seeing any sort of unity now. I think a lot of people, though, have looked at what happened on January 6th and the fact that on January 6th, we saw people who were prosecuted, who have been put in jail, who actually participated in it. But at the top, we never really saw like the what you would say the ringleaders that who was behind it, the motions behind it. That's never been prosecuted. And no one's been held accountable, let's put it that way. And so in the back of people's minds, I don't think that was a lesson to, you know, say, hey, this is too far. So you wonder, in the back of everyone's mind, what is too far? Is civil war actually in the back of people's minds? I wonder that.
While we're on the topic of the Republican nominee for vice president, one of J.D. Vance's comments from 2021 is coming back to haunt him this election cycle. Back then, Vance groused to Fox News' Tucker Carlson that our country was being run by, quote, childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives. He pointed to Vice President Harris, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and even Pete Buttigieg, adding, quote, the entire future of the Democrats is controlled by people without children. And how does it make any sense that we've turned our country over to people who don't really have a direct stake in it? The comments are getting a lot of bipartisan backlash. On Friday, he sat down with former Fox News host Megyn Kelly. Here's what Vance had to say.
I know the media wants to attack me and wants me to back down on this, Megyn, but the simple point that I made is that having children, becoming a father, becoming a mother, I really do think it changes your perspective in a pretty profound way. This is something, of course, we've recognized for hundreds of years in this country that human civilization has always recognized. But there's a deeper point here, Megyn. It's not a criticism of people who don't have children. I explicitly said in my remarks, despite the fact the media has lied about this, that this is not about criticizing people who, for various reasons, didn't have kids. This is about criticizing the Democratic Party for becoming anti-family and anti-child.
Joe, I don't think I have gone back and re-listened to the 2021 marks. I don't take it as a, I'm not sure, I don't know, I'm looking for the right words here, clearly.
Yeah, you know, this was something that was said that has really raised, it opened a Pandora box. I mean, first of all, how do you define a family? Who has a family? I mean,
Kamala Harris has stepchildren.
She does. And she...
Pete Buttigieg, after those comments, adopted children.
There are people who have had children by IVF, and there's questions as to how Vance stands on IVF. A lot of people point to comments he's made in the past to say he wouldn't support IVF. You know, what is a family? So that draws into it. But then beyond that, the idea that you're not a fully participating, aware voter if you don't have children or if your children are grown or whatever. It's just kind of insulting on some level, because a lot of women who do not have children, it's not because of choice. Sometimes it is. And it's okay if it is, but it's not because of choice sometimes. And there are other things at bay that, you know, you have a vested interest, whether you have children or not, as to whether your air is clean. You have a vested interest into the amount of taxes you pay. I mean, people who have children and not don't have children have a lot of the same interests. So I think what he might have been trying to say could have been said a heck of a lot better. And he probably thinks that too, in hindsight, but I don't know. I haven't really talked to him about it. So
no. You know, Laura, it also raises that question, because it goes along with other comments that Vance has said, also in separate interviews from 2021. He said that, you know, people who choose not to have children should have less political power, face higher tax rates, that parents should get to have extra votes for the number of children that they have.
Right. I think that there's this is a serious conversation. How are we going to maintain our public investments with fewer people because of a declining birth rate? This is a very serious thing. The way he went about it in 2021 was not a serious way. He came right out of the gate and attacked people. He doesn't know their lives. He doesn't know AOC and whether, you know, she wants to have kids. He doesn't know.
She's also like 31, I think.
Yeah,
she's pretty young and recently engaged. So there's
time. He doesn't know. And, you know, I was watching last week. I saw Meghan McCain on her TikTok page was criticizing it on Saturday. The Wall Street Journal's opinion page, not at all known to be liberal.
I was going
to
say a pretty conservative opinion page.
Their house editorial for that day came out against it. This was very divisive. And yes, we need to find solutions. But yeah, one of the examples he said is that people who don't have kids, you know, should pay more in taxes. But then he's also tried to backtrack by saying, well, we're not blaming people who couldn't conceive. We're just blaming people who chose. But how is the IRS going to determine whether to tax you more, whether you couldn't conceive versus whether you chose? You know what I mean? Like, so again, this is a very serious topic. He didn't approach it. He was trying to get a soundbite in 2021, and it's come back to haunt him.
Yeah, I also think it raises this question of if you choose not to have children, it sets up almost this dichotomy of either you choose to have kids or you're anti-family. Whereas I think you can choose not to have children and be pro-family.
Exactly. And what do you think about the maybe grandparents out there who have raised adult children and now they have grandkids? Do they get two votes because they have a child who produced more children? So do they get, you know, two or more votes, or do they get half a vote for, you know, it's just, you know,
what happens in divorce?
Yeah,
who gets the vote of the kids in divorce?
Yeah, there's a lot to that. And it blows my mind.
Oh, my producer is letting me know that Representative Ocasio-Cortez is 34.
Oh, 34. Okay.
So she's got time.
Yeah, she still does have time.
I actually want to move on to a former Yale Law School classmate of Senator J.D. Vance gave the New York Times correspondence that they had between 2014 through 2017. Now, Vance has downplayed this correspondence as decade-old private conversations between friends, and his campaign has said that it shows that Vance is open and not hateful or rejecting of people with different ideologies and political views. But these comments are an insight, perhaps, into the political evolution of J.D. Vance. So in 2014, after the killing of Michael Brown, Vance wrote that he hated the police. In 2015, Vance described Trump as a demagogue exploiting people who believe, quote, crazy stuff. I'm going to say stuff because I can't say the other word on the radio. In 2016, he wrote that the more white people feel like voting for Trump, the more black people will suffer. And he even added, I truly believe that. So, you know, Joe, Vance has addressed his anti-Trump comments for years now, saying he didn't think he would be a good president and sees the error of his ways. But some of these, I mean, I truly believe that black people will suffer under a Trump administration. It's, I don't know what to make of that 6 years old comment.
And I think if you listen to a lot of Republican pundits, they don't know what to make of it either, because, you know, we've been hearing in recent days some political pundits saying, hey, there's a great deal of remorse right now over choosing J.D. Vance. And I guess only former President Trump knows
whether he regrets it or not,
But, you know, there's even a question as to why Vance was chosen, because Ohio, as we have already said, is probably going to go to, you know, former President Trump. So it's not like, you know, Vance is bringing that. I think there is a great deal of money that comes with Vance that plays into this. But
I also think there was a hope that he would appeal to working class voters in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, potentially, that like rags to riches narrative would be sellable.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, maybe so. I don't know.
You know, let's move on to voting generally. So a federal judge has put on hold part of our state's new voting law that pertains to who can deliver ballots. So, Joe, why did the judge say that these new rules about who gets to take your ballot to the polling place were potentially unconstitutional?
Well, a lot of people were left out. Okay, first of all, under the current and now the existing situation since this ruling, someone who's disabled, like the grandchild, could help them vote and take the ballot in for them or help them mail.
These are
it
people
in.
Who can't physically get to a polling location.
These are disabled people who have issues with either mobility or, you know, just the mental wherewithal, different things that people have disabilities with, you know, maybe not being able to reach into a Dropbox, not being able to physically fill out something, but, you know, mentally clear enough to dictate what they want. And in the past, caregivers and, you know, family members, grandchildren and people like that could help them with this. They could, you know, mail the ballot for them, take the ballot in. But the new election law that was passed made it so that some of those people couldn't. And not only could they not do it, if they got caught helping someone, they faced felony charges. It was a big deal. So the League of Women Voters sued over this. And last week we found out that the court has put the disability part of that law. Now there's a lot of things.
That was one part of a big law.
That was one part of a much bigger law. And there are election changes that are coming about. But that part of the law has been put on hold for now. And, you know, it looks like the state usually appeals to protect its laws. So they'll probably appeal. They haven't yet that I know of. But it's
Yeah, I don't think they have yet.
10 o'clock.
But who knows? Stay tuned on that front. But, you know, Laura, this was passed as the whole reason for it was to prevent ballot harvesting, which is where you go and collect people's ballots mm-hmm. and turn them in. The idea being that that's a security risk, that someone could open them and change them or throw them out and put in new ones or whatever they were going to do with them. But what has been the reaction from, say, Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose to this ruling?
As far as I understand, and maybe I'm off, but I don't think we've heard yet, because we're still waiting to find out if they're going to appeal. And I know his office hasn't said anything about that per se.
Yeah.
I am sure they are not thrilled, because they supported, I mean, whenever the Republican controlled legislature is going to make big changes to voting, obviously they're going to go to the Republican Secretary of State, because he's sort of the expert. And so, you know, he was okay with the law as it was. So he can't be doing, you know, a dance over the fact that a Cleveland federal judge, you know, turned down that part of it.
And he did say that in a statement that he felt like lawmakers are the ones who are responsible for making these changes, not a court.
That was Joe Ingles with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Coming up, why the Ohio Supreme Court says it's okay to have bones in boneless chicken wings. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Erin Glynn, state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, and Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Can a chicken wing with a bone still be called boneless? According to the Ohio Supreme Court, the answer is yes. The court ruled 4-3 that boneless wings denote a cooking style and not a guarantee that your wing is bone-free. Erin, what is going on here?
Yes, so this is about a man who ordered boneless chicken wings at a restaurant in Hamilton, Ohio, in Butler County. He was eating them with a knife and fork, according to his complaint, and swallowed, I believe, a 1.5-inch bone and had some problems with his esophagus as a result. But the Supreme Court found, I mean, it was a 4-3 decision, so contentious. Decided that the name boneless does not mean that you do not anticipate bones in your chicken wings.
The ruling has made Democrats rather unhappy, saying that this is a larger issue with how public injury cases are litigated. Here's Senator Bill DeMora.
I don't know how any person with common sense or common knowledge or any kind of logic can determine that something that says boneless could have a bone in it.
DeMora also underscored the importance of the Ohio Supreme Court race this election, where Republicans hold that 4-3 majority, Joe.
Yeah, and that's going to, I'm going to predict that we're going to hear more about this boneless wing decision in the future, because, you know, on the face of it, people listen to, you know, the ruling of the court and they're like, what? You know, but I think that, you know, the Democrats see an opportunity here to say this court is out of touch. They think you can have bones and boneless chicken wings, you know, and so the court right now is the makeup. It could be shifted. And right now it's a Republican court, Republican majority that ruled on this. But it could change if they play their cards right. So they're going to be playing this up in the future. So if you don't know about the whole boneless chicken wing saga, you are going to find out soon.
You know, Laura, I do think it has that larger question of, like, what are we allowed to sue for when things go wrong? Because the guy in this case didn't just, like, get a bone stuck in his throat. There was an infection. He had multiple surgeries. It was the worst possible scenario for getting a bone in your wing.
He tore his esophagus, I believe. And so the Democrats in the decision said he should have had the right to go to trial to get his fair day in court. Republicans said, well, you just have to look at it from a reasonable standpoint. You know, these are all chicken products. You might have a bone or two once in a while. Now, Twitter, there's people on Twitter who are like, I'm going to start a, quote, vegan steakhouse. I'm going to start a, quote, sugar-free cupcake. You know, like,
yeah,
you know, you could totally do buyer beware, if that's really how far the Supreme Court wants to take it.
Yeah.
So I think that there will be a lot of campaigning in these coming months over that decision.
Speaking of Ohio's highest court, the justices have agreed to hear oral arguments about Marcy's Law, That's the law that is supposed to protect the victims of crime, but have been used in recent months by law enforcement to withhold the names of officers who fire their guns. Aaron, the Columbus Dispatch is part of this lawsuit, and that is part of your network. What exactly are they asking for clarification on here?
Yeah, I mean, as reporters, we want access to as much information as possible. And knowing the names of officers who've fired guns can be crucial in officer-involved shootings, seeing patterns among law enforcement officers. It gives the public information about, you know, who is enforcing the law in their town and what kind of history they have.
Yeah, and so essentially Marcy's Law, they've been using it to say, well, because usually there's an altercation that precedes a shooting, sometimes, like, it really depends on the facts, but they'll make the claim, well, the officer is now a victim of an alleged crime, and therefore their name is not public record.
Yeah, and, you know, there are questions as to, you know, voters approved Marcy's Law.
Overwhelmingly.
And, yeah, overwhelmingly. There are questions as to whether voters realized that that could be used that way when they approved it.
Whether they intended it.
Whether it was intended for that purpose. And it's been to shield the names of officers that a lot of people say, hey, you're a public servant. You're being paid with tax dollars. We deserve to know the name of who did this. And so you've got a real... you know, a real tug of war there with this information. And we'll just see where it lands, I guess.
The Ohio Secretary of State's office has a new top election lawyer. And for those who have been listening to the roundtable for a long time, his name is going to be familiar. It is former Ohio Senate President Larry Obhoff. Frank LaRose picked Obhoff as his chief legal counsel and deputy assistant secretary of state last week. So what qualifies him for this role?
Well, I didn't know he's Yale educated. That was a fact.
Another Yale graduate.
Yeah, it's a factoid I didn't know. And he has a very impressive legal background. If you read his legal background, he also has a very good knowledge of how the legislature works and who the players are and what the process, you know, should be. And so a lot of the things that LaRose is trying to deal with right now, we were talking earlier about the voter stuff, you know, a lot of that stuff, having that insight on what's going through lawmakers' heads and what they do to get it passed and what the intent is, that can be very helpful to Frank LaRose.
It also makes me wonder if Obhoff is maybe looking ahead to 2026 when Frank LaRose is term limited and maybe he can't run for another round as Secretary of State, Laura?
Yeah, Larry Obhoff has been out of office for what? Four years now.
Yeah.
He's been out for a while and he's just kind of been sitting there. I text him or he texts me every once in a while to say hi. But I've just been wondering, like, what are you going to do? Because he's young. I don't know, maybe 40, maybe not older than like 45. He's
really young.
So it's like, what are you going to do? You know, what's next? So, and I've heard rumors about Congress. I've heard all sorts of rumors.
I heard rumors that if Trump was reelected, he was hoping for a judicial appointment. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of those conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So being back in Columbus, he's from Medina, but being back in Columbus in the, a little bit more in the political realm, he'll be, you know, he's not going to be doing like a ton of statements or anything. That's still all Frank LaRose. Frank LaRose is the forward-facing person, but, you know, just being down here doing the political stuff puts him back in the game.
Yeah, I could also put my political tinfoil hat on and say, you know, if J.D. Vance becomes the vice president, Frank LaRose could become a U.S. senator, which could make Obhoff the Secretary of State if we want to play political musical chairs for a minute.
Well, there is that. There is that. You know, the governor's being very mum on what he would do in that situation, by the
way. Yes, because the Governor DeWine will get to appoint our next U.S. Senator if Vance vacates to take a job as vice president. Right. That person would serve until 2026, and we'd have another Senate election.
And if you remember who DeWine endorsed in the election, it was not Frank LaRose. He endorsed State Senator Matt Dolan.
Yeah, so we'll have to. Well, first Trump has to win the election, and then we got to decide what we're going to do with our
it's
Senate.
A big hypothetical there. Yeah. But, you know, we can't help but go to hypotheticals because they're interesting sometimes.
I mean, go ahead. There are a lot of people who are reaching out. Like during the Republican National Convention, a lot of Ohio Republicans were spending their like in between hours outside of the convention hall speculating who is going to run, who is making nicey-nice with Governor DeWine right now to be, you know, put on his, you know, mind.
Maybe list, yeah. I'm sure anybody with a remote interest in it has already let Governor DeWine know.
Mm-hmm. Probably so.
Laura, I want to get a quick update on where recreational marijuana stands. The Ohio Division of Cannabis Control has given certificates of operation to 10 growers and processors, one of which is in Columbus. So what does this allow them to do, and when do sales begin?
It just allows them to start operating as dual use, both medical and recreational. These companies right now are already open for recreational. This is not dispensaries, so there is nothing open for you or me or whomever to go and get marijuana. The Division of Cannabis Control has said that they want the supply there before the doors are flung open and the masses come in and there's not enough product. They also want to make sure that there's enough product for all of the medical patients so they can continue getting their stuff. And so at this point, you're just seeing this kind of slow rollout of these other lower parts of the supply chain, getting the approval to start acting within. So like a grower can grow cannabis for the market. A processor takes marijuana leaves and they compress them either mechanically, or there's some processes involving CO2 and other things where they, you know, they get it down to an oil and they can add it to an edible, to a gummy, to a soda, to a lotion, you know, that kind of thing. And then, you have testing labs that's next down, and they're checking for mold, pesticides, terpenes, percentage of THC, and then you have the dispensaries. So it's this big chain. And they have until September 7 to reject or okay everybody who's applied, who's a current medical marijuana operator, for a dual use license. That's in the law. And so that's basically the deadline they're working to. They're not making any guarantees it's going to be before then as far as when dispensaries are open. And that's just their part, what they have to okay. And then it's up to every business when they get the okay, if they want to. Like maybe a dispensary will wait a couple of days after they get their okay to actually open to the public. So they keep saying, you know, don't hold us. You can only hold us to September 7. Otherwise, we don't have... You know, we don't have a date for anybody. So it's coming, but it's not as fast as initially anticipated by some members of the legislature and members of like the marijuana investment community.
So stay tuned. And finally, the 169th Ohio State Fair opened last week, and Governor Mike DeWine did his annual Let's Look at Things and Talk to Reporters.
And eat weird things.
Yeah, it's a tradition. You follow him around the state fair. He gets snacks. He takes questions. Yeah. One of the things he talked about is upgrading the facilities there at the state fair. DeWine likened the facilities to an older home in need of improvement and said he plans to spend millions in upgrades.
Yeah, and some of that money's already been allocated through the capital budget. There was some money. There's also some money coming from some other sources. And that money's going to be used to take some of those buildings and either raise them or completely rehab them. He did say that, you know, the Butter Cow, we all are used to going in that dairy building and looking at the glass and seeing.
It's Olympians this year.
Yes, it is Olympians with the Butter Cow, right? We still have the Butter Cow, I think.
Yeah, they're wearing like little gold medals.
Yes, yes. So the Butter Cow, this is the last year, folks, that the Butter Cow is going to be in that building because Governor DeWine says it's moving to a new building, a new shiny building.
Oh.
So next
new
year
location for
different.
The Butter Cow.
Yeah.
That's important to know.
Big difference. Yeah.
Yeah. He also talked about how valued the real estate is there and how important it will be to monetize that location 365 days out of the year. Because the fair is only 10 days. Yeah.
That was really curious. I wanted to know more about that. When I heard that, I was like, wow, I wonder. You know, I think there has always been that in the back of lawmakers' minds and stories I've read. They've talked about different options. So we'll see what comes about there.
The Ohio State Fair continues through August 4th.
And you can get one of those, what is it, a cotton candy cream puff this year.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, it sounds sickening sweet, but if you're into cotton candy cream puffs or any other fried sweet thing, you can probably
find it. That's the place to go. Mm-hmm. That was Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Aaron Glynn, state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau.
Thanks.
And thanks to Laura Hancock, politic and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, who showed up even though she's sick. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable right here on 89.7 NPR News.